old, I understand.
Oh, well, we are unique among the 75 dying coal towns of West Virginia, East Kentucky, and Southwest Virginia in the fact that we sit at the foot of the National Forest. Everything is for sale in the town for literally. We had a wonderful historic district here. We are a federal historic district. 50 empty stores on Main Street, but a couple of them are starting to come back organically. We have a wood mill here. We need to do value-added wood. There's a lot of things we can do here, but, you know, the state has just simply not been supportive of looking at any kind of alternative green visions. So my mayorship and Richwood is a bit of an anomaly in the system in that my election is almost a curiosity because the state is becoming redder and redder and redder.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but we will certainly follow your mayoralty. Bob Henry Baber, mayor-elect of Richwood, West Virginia, which is experiencing a once-in-a-thousand-year flood. Ken Pimlott, director of California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, thanks for joining us, and Professor Michael Mann. That does it for our broadcast. We have job openings. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today's guest is Jan Dilge, who will tell us about the 100th anniversary of Margaret Sanger, who founded the first birth control clinic in the U.S. She was actually thrown in jail for distributing information about birth control. After that, we'll talk about the United Kingdom's vote to be less united with the European Union.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival, the hallmark event for the Oregon Food Bank. This year, the festival will be held July 1st through 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. Everyone will need a pass this year to see such artists as Dr. John and the Night Trippers, Liv Warfield and the Special Horns, Curtis Salgado, and many more. More information about passes, the performers, the role of the Oregon Food Bank, and more can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Yay! This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio. Bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. We're accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Wednesday, August 10th. The sale will be held in mid-August. Stay tuned for details. Please, no home-recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
Another bride, another June, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee. A lot of shoes, a lot of rice, the groom is nervous, he answers twice, it's really killing that he's so willing to make whoopee. Picture a little.
Okay, yeah, here it is, making whoopee. Ho, ho, ho. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, 90.7 on your FM here in KBOO land in Portland.
Yep.
And Abe Proctor, me, Joe Uris, we want to hear from you. We got two topics today, and we got a guest.
Yeah, we do.
We do. We have Jan Dilge, who is going to talk to us about a plan to dramatize the Margaret, the Sanger thing.
Indeed.
The yeah. Sanger thing.
The Sanger thing.
That's sort of oblique.
Well, it's Margaret Sanger was a fighter for women's, and well, actually reproductive rights for everybody, but particularly for women, putting out information about everything from condoms to what was then available in the way of products to block the conception of women.
And when was this?
When was this?
Well, she started in 1910 or so, but she was in Portland in 1916 on her first nationwide tour, lecture tour. She went to 17 cities and came to Portland on her West Coast swing, and it was June of 1916. She arrived. Everyone seemed happy to have her. There were all these benign conversations with her at the Portland Hotel where she was sipping Loganberry juice, and a couple days later, there were near riots when she, local Dr. Marie Equi, a couple of other birth control advocates were arrested for distributing her family limitation pamphlet, which had been deemed obscene, lewd, and indecent by the Portland City Council.
What was it? Did it have the pictures of people doing it, or what was the deal?
It did not have pictures of people doing it. It had pictures of women showing them how to place a diaphragm in their vagina, which was considered obscene. There was discussion of the pleasures and joy that women, as well as men, should derive from sex. And
well, there you go. That's all wrong. Go ahead.
Exactly. And actually, the five male city council members had gone into emergency session, secret session, to pass this ordinance that would deem it obscene and allow for the arrests. And it was so interesting. Actually, Emma Goldman had been here the year before in 1915.
Emma Goldman, the anarcho man, bad woman.
She and Sanger definitely connected on the issue of birth control and women's controlling their own bodies.
Okay.
And so there had been some precedent. There were some men arrested as well as some women. It was a joint effort. There actually had been a Portland Birth Control League formed following Goldman's visit. And so there were about 66 members who'd signed cards and were very active by the time Sanger arrived in town in June of 1916.
So what are you doing for this event?
Well, there was a group of us that decided that this was an important 100th anniversary to mark. The 100th anniversary actually is June 29th. We're doing some street theater in downtown Portland. They got arrested in the streets. We figured that was the right place to be to commemorate this anniversary. So there's a group of us who will be dressed in early 20th century clothing.
Cool.
And we'll be talking about the issues that were raised about birth control then and making some connections to the relevance of why, amazingly, birth control is still controversial today. We'll start at 11 o'clock at the Oregon Historical Society on their outdoor plaza. There will be speeches. The Raging Grannies are joining us. There will be singing.
Oh, wait a minute. Not
oh,
the,
Raging,
the Raging
no,
Grannies.
The Raging so Grannies. Awesome.
Oh, they're bad. They're bad.
They're fantastic.
Okay.
They have some special birth control songs that they will in their repertoire that they will be showcasing. And then we'll move to a couple of different locations, probably with, you know, whoever shows up. We're hoping that people will come to, you know, whatever portion of it that they can. It's between 11 and 1 p.m. We'll go from OHS to Shemansky Park, and then we'll make our way over to what was the site of the Baker Theater, which is where Sanger and Equi and the others were arrested, which is on Broadway near Morrison. And then from there, we will reenact the march that the hundreds of women and men following the police wagon to the Multnomah County Courthouse did in 1916.
I think that's great. Follow the police wagon.
They were. It was the scene there was described as a near riot, and there were women and men shouting, "Arrest us, too. We've broken the law, too." So we'll make our way over to our last stop about 1240, 1245 at the Multnomah County Courthouse, actually in Lounsdale Square across the street. Mm-hmm. And there will be more singing there, too.
Well, I was just looking at online. There's a wonderful collection. It's called the Margaret Sanger Papers Project, which
yes.
you can read about her life. And it describes in detail her visit to Portland. And they reproduce a lot of the language of the day that was used to comment at the time. And it's pretty funny. For example, after the deputy city attorney, who was arguing against prosecuting three men and four women locally who were helping Sanger distribute her materials. He argued, quote, "The evidence shows that these circulars or pamphlets were distributed promiscuously at the meetings held. These pamphlets should not be circulated here or anywhere else." Circulating promiscuously. I love that.
Well, and Sanger addressed that after their conviction, which pretty much the women were found guilty. The men were fined $10, but nothing much happened, you know, beyond that. And she's had this to say, that she considered it a cowardly decision. It's practically the same old story that knowledge, if hidden away on the musty bookshelves or in the narrow confines of the medical profession, is moral. But as soon as it is distributed among the working people, the same book becomes obscene.
So we're really talking about a class-based argument for birth control here.
That was definitely an early focus of Sanger's, and it was clearly a focus of hers and local Dr. Marie Equi on this particular stop in 1916. And Sanger, or Equi, actually rewrote the pamphlet while during these couple of different lectures that occurred during Sanger's visit, trying to make it less obscene. And she referred to, you know, that the reason this pamphlet was being rewritten was due to the stupid persecution of the all-male city council. And so, you know, they were aware that there seemed to be objections about the fact that they were giving it to everyone. And the women who were involved in some of the protests were clear about that, too. They said the poor should have what the rich already possess, that if you had enough money to go to a doctor, he was going to give you the same information, or she was going to give you the same information. But for poor women who maybe didn't have that access, or men, they didn't have a way to find out. And so this pamphlet was, Family Limitation, was chock full of, you know, how to use a pessary and, you know, what kind of anti-spermicidal suppositories you could use, or douches. And it was so very practical ingredients that you could find, you know, and do yourself. And that it was that do it yourself and, you know, women in control that really set people off.
So, I mean, I'm seeing a parallel with the struggle right now on abortion issue.
Sure.
And it's obvious that aside from the meta argument of the instant creation of a human being that involves an egg and a sperm joining, that really what this is about the tradition of power in the hands of men. I mean, I can't see it any other way. I don't know. I mean,
well, I would agree, and I would say the abortion debate is very much about that as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, the two are different in ways, but certainly very connected.
Well, and of course, we also coincidentally have the Texas decision, which was, what, yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
Which essentially, despite the efforts, all the good efforts of the Republicans not to have a Supreme Court that has any liberal bias, ended up saying, hey, Wade v. Roe is absolutely the law. The courts decided this. We're not going to change that. And the fact of the matter is that Texas invents ways, as do many other states imitating Texas, to make it very difficult for women to get an abortion.
Well, and access to birth control is sometimes very much connected with that. You know, some of that is changing with new medical developments about day after pills and things like that.
Right.
But it's still, you know, the fact that women can't readily, you know, have access to this, you know, these needs that they have, you know, for information and pills and, you know, whatever it is, you know, at the ready, you know, at wherever it is they live, is it's nuts. And I would be really interested in knowing what Sanger or Equi thought about where we are 100 years later.
Well, it is an interesting question. And also it's important to know that there is a deep, I don't know how else to characterize except a reactionary Christian fundamentalist movement, which we see in both some black churches and some white churches, which essentially argues a magical notion about contraception and about conception, which is that the minute a sperm penetrates an egg, that is a person. And it reminds me a little bit of the kind of almost Middle Ages idea that a sperm is actually a little person that is swimming along there, actually a little homonucleus, I believe it was called, that joins an egg and that gives women really only the passive role of being a vessel for the production of humans.
Well, I might suggest that it extends a little farther beyond just the fundamentalist community. You know, I think there's a wide swath of humanity, a lot of it male, you know, who are still in the power positions of power to make these decisions, who women having control is just a scary idea to them.
Well, I'm absolutely terrified of that. I'm absolutely terrified of that. Women in control.
Margaret Sanger, in addition to her groundbreaking work on contraception and informing people on how to do it, also was a eugenicist and a bit of a racist. And also saw birth control as a means to keep, in her words, the feeble-minded from reproducing. Now, are you going to touch upon this in your discussion of Sanger as well?
Well, I would say it's going to be, we will touch on it. And there are none of us that are involved in the birth control brigade that'll be putting on mm-hmm. this street theater tomorrow that supports those views of hers.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. And I wasn't implying that you do.
No. But I mean, within the confines of street theater, yes, we will be addressing okay. that. And I would say in all the literature that we've put out, our press releases, we've connected to a couple of organizations. Trust Black Women is one. A great article by Imani Gandhi in Rewire magazine about how a lot of the, about how all of that is true. Some of it perhaps a bit more nuanced than has been portrayed by the anti-birth control abortion movement. You know, there's just no excusing her eugenicist involvement. And, you know, the fact that she was so, mono-directed about, you know, birth control, mm-hmm. that this seemed, a way to accomplish that, or that she actually believed that, you know, there's no whitewashing that.
Well, I think we need to understand, the fact of the matter is the United States has always been, and still unfortunately is, a racist society. And the assumptions of that society, particularly at that time, when women couldn't vote, when persons of color were essentially in a quasi-slave status in the South, when all of that was going on, is really relevant. Also, there was the assumption that, and this is really relevant to Britain now, when we're seeing an assumption that persons of color or persons of a different ethnicity than Anglo-Saxon are inferior inherently. And that is an enormously culturally based, dangerous bias that has not disappeared. Mm-hmm. It really hasn't. So ironically, this, which might have nothing to do with what our next topic is going to be, which is Brexit, this is really relevant to that. This is the foundational biases of a very racist and nationalist set of notions, which at the time really assumed that the good people were Anglo-Saxon.
Well, and I think specifically on the racism issue, there's no doubt that Sanger held some racist views, but she also worked rather closely with members of the Black and African American community. She worked with, she opened a clinic in Harlem that had a lot of Black advisors, a Black staff. She was working with W.E. Du Bois, Walter White, Mary McLeod Bethune. So she did have some collaborative pieces to her work in birth control. So I think it's a little more nuanced, and I think some of the racism and comments that are attributed to her, we've learned as we've been working on this project, were really kind of misattributed, and that, doesn't excuse everything, but it was perhaps more nuanced than we all kind of think.
I applaud you for embracing the woman in her totality. I think it's important when we're talking about figures like this to, you know, present the entire person. So good on you for that.
And I also think it's important to understand that essentially there's a vast web of reaction right now. Essentially, I see it as an attack on women's control of their own bodies, which is going on. And it is going on fiercely, particularly in the United States and particularly in places like Texas. So we need, all of us need to pay attention. I think it's kind of neat to talk about Margaret Sanger. Besides, you guys are all going to dress funny.
We are. You will not miss us. And we will have placards that are replicas from some of the marches and then some of the protests outside of the Multnomah County Courthouse when they were on trial. The trials were, all seven of them were tried on the same day in what was then the Multnomah County Courthouse and jail. It was in the exact same location that the Multnomah County Courthouse is now.
I think it's really funny that the city council met in secret to pass a law. I think that in and of itself is pretty indicative of something. Do we want to go to our phones, just have a couple of calls and then?
Sure. Jeremy, good morning.
Hi, I'm here. I didn't realize I've got you in bed. My speaker wasn't loud enough. Can I turn off my radio? Which is
please turn off your radio.
I'm plugging the phone and moving away from the radio. I'm going outside. Anyway, I'm glad Abe got that out there. She seems to be generally lionized in a way that seems, I think, historically inaccurate.
Margaret Sanger, you mean?
Yes. She married a multimillionaire. And I think, you know, whatever progressivism was, you know, it was very important what she did. However, I think she somewhat did it for the wrong reasons. And then the rest of her life, it was really about keeping those poor people from multiplying. I mean, eugenics is a big deal. It's not just this little sideshow to a feminist hero. I think it drove her behavior, and it, you know, Hitler learned from the American eugenics movement. He got his inspiration from it, you know? The unworthy, having children, is something we need to stop. You know, whether they be Jews, gypsies, trade unionists, or, you know, other than you know, European whites. And I'm happy to learn about her Portland history, but I think her general valorization and lionization is basically grotesque. I would feel that way even if I, you know, didn't lose relatives as a Jew. I would feel that way, because I think it dominated her inspiration. The bad stuff. It wasn't the sideshow. It was the main show.
I appreciate the comment, Jeremy.
I think she, you know, she did that work in Harlem because she wanted to stop, you know, the gigaboos from multiplying.
Well, okay, thanks.
Hey, thanks for the call.
This whole, it's really important to understand politically the structure of the attack on women's reproductive rights that's taking place right now. And it is definitely the case that we are talking about a society which was extremely racist, overtly racist, during the period of time that she operated. And it's definitely the case that there was a notion that you could somehow breed a better human group, and it was definitely a bias toward Anglo-Saxons. But I think it is also really important to understand, and going beyond that, to understand the empowerment that contraception, that the control of one's own body is, how important it is for women. And I cannot emphasize that enough. And I want to make clear that that's really still, unfortunately, a struggle going on today.
It is. And I think that keeping, you know, there are a lot of aspects to Sanger, but I'm just not going to, you know, say that her work on birth control wasn't important, wasn't essential, doesn't really shape how our world is today and some of the struggles that are still going on today.
Well, and also you don't get to choose your allies in many kinds of struggles, you know, in terms of their ideological assumptions. Mm-hmm. And I think that also there's something else going on here. Doing this right now, having these little performances, emphasizes how serious the struggle for reproductive rights really is, even now. So when you use a historical model, You gain, I don't know how many crowds you'll get, but you gain a crowd of people listening. It helps people understand really a very, very crucial and very significant struggle that women, largely women with the support of men, underwent to get contraception in the society. When we look at the whole history of knowledge of sexuality, it has always been difficult, And it's basically, I think, around the issues of puritanical thinking, notions about religion and its tie-in with human sexuality, all that stuff, which I think is, I personally think is kind of garbage.
Well, and I'm a historian and a teacher, and so, you know, I want people to maybe get intrigued, maybe get enraged about Sanger and go and find out. Do the reading. Go to the Margaret Sanger papers. Go to some of these other links that we have up and read her words.
Yeah.
See who she was associated with, what she did, what the actual people living at the time had to say, and make your decision for yourself.
So Jan, let's just summarize here.
Sure.
What's going to happen and when?
So the Birth Control Brigade will be meeting up with whoever cares to join us, and we hope it will be many of you, at the Oregon Historical Society at 11 o'clock tomorrow, June 29th. And we will be moving through downtown, doing street theater, talking about the issues of the day and how they are related to the issues currently.
Great. Great.
You'll
great.
Recognize us. We'll be in the long dresses and the big hats.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for joining us today. Really
Thanks
appreciate
for having
it. And me. Thank you for bringing this to everyone's attention.
Thanks so much.
All right.
We are going to totally change, I guess.
Yes, we are.
Totally. Change topics. Brexit.
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 All right. As
so
you...
do not call us about reproductive rights now.
Although I guarantee we will be revisiting this issue in the future.
Okay. Thank you very much, yeah. Jan.
So unless you've been hiding under a rock, you probably heard that the United Kingdom voted last week by a narrow margin to leave the European Union.
Yes.
This is a big deal. This is a big deal that bodes ill not only for the future of the European Union itself as it now exists, but also for the entire post-war order that was imposed by the victorious Allies at the end of the Second World War. So this is kind of a big deal.
Oh, it is a big deal, but it's also very odd because apparently, and this is really hard to get to the core of it, but apparently many people who voted for it were actually voting against having foreigners coming into Britain and taking the jobs of the British, even though, in fact, Britain's dilemmas stem largely from the fact that society has become very much post-industrial in the West.
Yeah, indeed it has. You can draw very broad parallels between the vote in Britain to leave the European Union and the rise of reactionary right-wing nationalist parties throughout Europe and the rise of Donald Trump here in the United States. It seems there is an ignorant nucleus of citizens in all of these places that is feeling its position of economic security erode and has decided to blame entirely the wrong people. They are pointing their fingers at immigrants, usually immigrants with darker skin than theirs, mm-hmm. and blaming them for the erosion of their economic security, rather than blaming the 1%, who are the real problem here. So this, as I mentioned, bodes ill for the future of the European Union. Now, that means something, I think, both concrete and abstract. Now, the European Union, what is it exactly? This was an economic entity primarily, not a political one, formed a few decades ago. I don't know the exact date of its formation. It is a loose confederation of European states who decided to form a common market, get rid of trade barriers between member nations, ensure mobility of citizens between member nations, and also throughout most of the Eurozone to share a common courtesy, a common currency backed by a central bank. Now, this sounds like a lot of economic mumbo jumbo, but it's pretty damn significant when one considers the history of the European continent over the past, say, 3,000 years. There have been very, very few extended periods of peace on the European continent. In fact, you probably would have to go as far back as the Pax Romana in the early centuries AD to look at a longer stretch of uninterrupted peace than the one we've seen over the past few decades in Europe.
And even that's questionable. And, I mean, there were rebellions and border fights constantly.
There were, yes. So despite the fact that the European Union was not the United States of Europe, to draw a broad analogy, it was still pretty damn important from a historical standpoint. And I think offered a very meaningful example of countries deciding to take positive and proactive steps to ensure that they weren't all at each other's throats once again in an incredibly destructive way. So Britain's exit, if it causes more dominoes to fall, more nations to leave the European Union, this is a step, a significant step away from international cooperation as we understand it.
Well, that's really true. And I want to add one other historical reality. After World War II, there was a creation. Remember, England exhausted itself in the two world wars.
Yeah.
Economically. In the course of the situation in which the United States gained enormous power and control over Western Europe, while the Soviet Union gained enormous power and control over Eastern Europe, in the course of that, a meeting was held in Bretton Woods, and that led to the creation of the World Bank, which would always have an American head, and the International Monetary Fund, which was to be the emergency fund in this situation. Mm-hmm. That is the real root, the real beginning economically of the situation that led inevitably, I think it really was inevitably to the attempt to create a united Europe. That is now not jeopardized particularly or directly, but by implication is jeopardized. There's another element here. I always had the bias of thinking, well, Europeans, you know, they're in a world where they have to know more stuff, internationally speaking. But in fact, in Great Britain, in the United Kingdom, there is a great deal of ignorance and a great deal of class-based anger. And that is what is, I think, largely reflected, not to mention racism, which I should mention, that led to this decision. Many people apparently thought that they were voting to stop persons of color coming into, or Poles for that matter, who work at a lower wage, from coming into England and taking, and perceived to be taking the jobs of British people. So, you know, really there is a nationalist element and a proto-fascist element to this thing and an ignorance that is very, very scary. Very scary. And of course, I love the fact that Donald Trump thinks it's wonderful because the fascist clown can do no wrong.
Trump was, in case you missed this, I think the day after the vote, was in Scotland presiding over the opening of a new luxury golf resort.
Well, actually trying to boost his golf resort.
Boost his already existing golf resort.
It was a failure.
Yeah. So he spoke very glowingly about the Brexit vote, about how England was taking their country back again. And it was incredibly ironic because there he was in Scotland, and Scotland, almost to a voter, elected to remain with the European Union.
Right.
It was England and English nationalism that drove this vote. Scotland, it seems, is a little bit smarter. And Trump, apparently, even dumber than we originally thought he was.
Well, you can't underestimate the dumbness of Donald Trump. I mean, he's...
He's pretty dumb.
He's really, really, really an ignorant man.
Yeah.
It's very bizarre. It proves that you can, if you inherit a large sum of money, take that money and turn it into a larger sum of money without any brain whatsoever.
Indeed. But also, if he had taken his large sum of money and simply invested it in the market, he'd be even wealthier now than he is.
Oh, so, the irony of it all.
The irony of it all. But anyway, so Britain leaving the European Union, this, in addition to the economic ramifications, which are many and pretty esoteric, so I'm not going to get into a lot of economic mumbo-jumbo right at this moment.
I say fal-de-ral rather than mumbo-jumbo.
That's where we differ, Joe.
Okay.
This going forward, this has all sorts of ramifications with regard to international cooperation on any number of issues that are pressing not only to the Western world, to the industrialized world, but to humanity writ large. We have to get a grip on climate change, for example. And if the European Union were to fragment it's going to be that much more difficult to bring the advanced economies to a place where they are no longer contributing to the warming of our planet.
But it's also important to understand that what happened in the creating of the union was not well thought out. The creation of a monetary system without a real banking system, the creation of a set of rules that could not necessarily apply to the southern states of Europe as it did to the northern states of Europe, was really short-sighted and foolish. So there's a lot of stuff going on here that really relates to the relative differences in income and wealth and power of the various nations involved and trying to paper it over a lot. Meanwhile, I think it's really important to understand the role of Germany in this, which is very powerful.
Yeah, it's also important to understand the divide, the cultural and economic divide between North and South in Europe, which is pretty profound, as are the prejudices that are baked into the minds of many people in the North. For example, when the bottom fell out of the world economy in 2008, in Europe, this was felt most keenly among several of the Southern European nations, most notably Greece and Spain. And make no mistake, this was largely portrayed in the North as a function somehow of the degeneracy and the backwardness of these darker-skinned, poorer Southern European nations. So this is one of the factors that led to the European Union's mistaken, disastrous embrace of austerity policies as an answer to the economic disaster of 2008. And it was framed in those terms. Oh, we, the rich North, are going to have to bail out the poor, irresponsible South. That was not only an inaccurate portrayal of the factors that led to the collapse in 2008, but a very racist response. And really, the austerity that has been practiced in Europe has delayed the economic recovery of that continent by years. And even the anemic demand-side stimulus that we experienced in the United States looks like manna from heaven in comparison to the hardcore austerity that was practiced throughout Europe.
Yeah, and I want to just throw something in that probably most of our listeners know, but it's really important to understand. In recent economic talks and theory, one of the two key elements of an understanding of large macroeconomics is missing. And we learned this in school, I hope. Supply, which is being emphasized a lot right now, and demand. People who don't have enough money, who don't have a disposable income that's large enough to support the vast creation of stuff, are not going to be able to buy that stuff, even with credit. Supply is important. But demand is equally important, and we do not have a demand-based economy.
Demand is more important, Joe. Here's why. We look back, as we often do on this program, to the policies of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal. What was the New Deal, essentially? Well, broadly speaking, it was a mobilization of government resources spent directly to employ Americans at any number of things, from building infrastructure to teaching school. And the idea behind this was demand-side stimulus, meaning if we give somebody a job, if we put money in his or her pocket, they will go out and they will spend that money. And in doing so, will invigorate the entire economy. Roosevelt, the analogy he used was priming the pump, meaning you got to put a little water in the pump to get it going so that it really starts gushing eventually. That was the analogy. And it's true. If you put money in people's pockets, they will go out and spend it. That's what elevates the economy. Not cutting taxes for rich people, not lavishing more wealth on the, quote, job creators. That is a falsity that has never borne up in any sort of concrete way. The Reagan myth of low taxes on the wealthy as a means of boosting the economy is a falsehood. There is no evidence to support it whatsoever. Now, Roosevelt detractors will say it was the Second World War that lifted the United States out of the Depression, not the New Deal. That's also not true. We were already starting to pull ourselves out of the Depression when the Second World War came along. And it's important to understand that the sort of spending and the sort of economic mobilization that happened in the Second World War was also demand-side stimulus, because it put a whole bunch of Americans to work, not only building material for the war, but it put them to work fighting the war. It was demand-side stimulus as well. I'm not advocating for another world war. Please don't misunderstand me here.
I always think you're advocating for a third
war. Right, exactly. So in 2008, when the global economy tanked, Europe responded not with demand-side stimulus, but with hardcore austerity. Like, we're not going to give anybody anything. That's why the European economy languished for so long. That's why unemployment in Spain is still above 20%. That's why youth unemployment in Greece is approaching 50%.
Yeah, no, this is really very important. It's also important to understand that because the U.S. came out of the war wealthier than any place else, decisions that were made, like the so-called miracle of Germany, which was essentially American money put into Germany, rebuilt Germany, created a vast, successful state, the same to a lesser extent, but also mm-hmm. the same in France and in Italy and in Northern Europe generally. That was an amazing, a miraculous thing, very different than what happened after World War I. And it was a, you know, it was a learning experience for the whole world. That has now sort of been forgotten.
It has, yes. So we talked about Britain's exit from the European Union and the possible dissolution of the European Union as a step back and an erasure of the world order that was established, admittedly, by the Western countries after the Second World War. This is a step backward, in my opinion. What do I mean by that? Well, as you just mentioned, we really... By we, I mean the United States and its victorious allies in the Second World War, took some unprecedented steps to ensure that war didn't break out in Europe again, and by extension, didn't break out all over the world again. They formed institutions like the United Nations, like NATO, and it helped also at that time that there was it was a bipolar world, that there was a big old enemy that the Western nations faced in the Soviet Union. And that was a galvanizing factor at that time, too. So when the Soviet Union fell, that spirit of cooperation and prevention of future mass violence persevered in the creation of the European Union, which, as we mentioned, is more of an economic alliance than a political one. But so to see that go, that is a step backward.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that's what's going to happen. You know, this is an advisory vote, ironically. I don't think Americans know that. The Brexit
right.
is not a matter of law. It's a matter of the will of the people as stated in a referendum.
Exactly. But for a government to ignore the will of a people stated in a referendum, that is a slippery slope and a dangerous move.
Well, that's really true. And there's you know, we're talking about, we mentioned Trump here, but we also need to understand the struggle between Boris Johnson and David Cameron in the
Conservative Party.
Conservative Party. Yeah. And you know, Boris and David were school buddies, school rivals, and they go back way, way, way back. Meanwhile, in the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn is having, while having ideological support, is having some problems because he's not very charismatic.
Well, he's facing a vote of no confidence.
Right. So there's a real chaos in leadership, a lack of leadership in Great Britain.
Yeah.
But I think we should go to the phone.
I think we should, too. Who do we have, Steve? George, good morning.
Oh, I want to say 231-8187.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You guys have been hitting on the important themes, it seems to me, so much in this discussion. And yet, every now and then, the way someone puts it kind of shows that it's so hard even for people who are really well-informed, and I mean both of you, and deep thinkers, it's easy to slip. And recently you said
that's
that
true.
After World War II, the importance of the post-war agreements in preventing the breaking out of war again. And yes, but war did break out again, and it has never stopped. And you know what I mean, class war. And I just finished looking through a slim book borrowed from a Wyoming University library, where it may not get much circulation. And it's called Against the Troika by a couple of radicals from, I think, Germany and Greece. And they point out just what you've been really underlining, that class war is going on, that the European Union bureaucracy in Brussels is just relentlessly neocon and determined to wreck the social services parachutes in the European countries. And I just want to thank you guys for underlining this. And one more thing, as you transitioned out of the discussions about Marie Ecuy and Margaret Sanger, you said, well, we're going to change subjects completely. And I'd like to offer just a modest difference of opinion, because Naomi Klein mentioned in a speech the other week, I think it was on alternative radio, that all of these topics, whether it's climate change or women's rights, or whether it's about the shooting of people of color by the police, all of them are tied together in this, the aspects of class war. And we need to remember that the system is really leading us into more human destruction and lives of people every day. So thank you guys for the terrific discussions. And I'll get off and just, I'm interested to listen to the rest of the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. 231-8187. What's the deal with the internet there? Do we have any?
Well, the internet's there, and I've been using it, yes.
Okay, good for you. That's very good.
The European Union was founded in 1993. The Eurozone, meaning the adoption of the common currency a few years later.
Yeah.
There are now 19 member states.
I got to say, the whole problem really is the fact that the old monies of the nation states of Europe, France, mm-hmm. Germany, et cetera, was much prettier than the euro.
And I think that is exactly
the problem. It's an
aesthetic
problem.
It was an aesthetic
an aesthetic problem. 231-8187.
Who's next, Steve? David, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I think it's only the Anglophile countries that are making a big deal of this. I mean, if you ask most Americans, what do we see from Britain in this country? They don't have textiles. You know, they don't have electronics. I mean, there's a few Rolls-Royce engines for airplanes, but hey, there's others. There's GE and everything. And, you know, I have to say, what's the big deal? You know, the biggest exports of Britain in the history has been racism, colonialism, and wiping out indigenous cultures. They can't do that anymore. You know, they have to do it because they're on that godforsaken island that has nothing. And so, hey, they're not going to come out and rape and pillage the world anymore. So let them have their own, you know, closed society. Let them be their own Anglophiles. We're the bastard country of that place. And look how they treated us in the American Revolution. So, you know, I don't know what the big deal is, honestly. Let them go hide in the island. They're still going to have to get stuff from everyone else in the world because they have nothing on that island.
Okay. Hey,
so
listen.
What's the big deal?
All right.
And they're still adhering to this monarchy royalty that somehow the king and queen have superior genetic makeup and we're supposed to worship them. I mean, it's so silly.
Well,
what's the big deal?
Hey, thanks for the call.
Thank you. I would like to point out just very briefly that the Windsors were originally German and had a German name, that in fact the Glorious Revolution ushered in a non-English monarchy. People don't know that, but it's a true fact. Anyway, we want to hear from you. We're talking primarily about Brexit and the implications of it. And it's very bizarre because, I mean, to me, the most amazing thing was to see Donald Trump with his failed golf course, where he's deeply, deeply, deeply disliked in Scotland. And he's talking like Scotland was supporting the exit, which is the opposite of the truth. In fact, in the vote on remaining within the United Kingdom, Scotland understood that there would continue to be a European Union.
Yep.
And they may now leave. They may now leave the United Kingdom. And the same is true for Northern Ireland.
Right.
So it's really a shakeup of great significance.
But, and the caller asks, what's the big deal? Shouldn't Britain just be left to its own devices? Because we don't get anything for Britain anyway. I think that's not the best way to understand this.
No.
Yes, there are ramifications for Britain itself, but there are larger ramifications in terms of the future of institutions created to bring nations into harmony with one another and act as a depressing force against the outbreak of violence between nations.
Well,
that, in my mind, is the biggest implication.
And you're right. And then there's the marvelous cooking, which Britain is well known for.
Right. And it's thespians. Let's not forget that.
No,
that's not. Coming up this morning on KBOO, and at 9, Alternative Radio presents the late Howard Zinn speaking on Second Thoughts on the First Amendment. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15 on Flashpoints, reproductive justice advocate Renee Bracey Sherman discusses yesterday's Supreme Court decision striking down Texas anti-abortion laws. Also, investigative reporter Bob Perry examines why the Brits voted to leave the EU. At 11, Stage and Studio presents an in-depth look at safety for women in theater, inspired by a recent Chicago Reader article about on- and offstage abuse that shocked theater communities around the country. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Andre Middleton interviews Judy Jacobson of Hap Gallery, which shows contemporary artists, explores curatorial issues, and experiments with gallery practices. All this and more coming up on KBOO.
You know, we do great programming.
We really do. Awesome music. I really can't overstate that.
Making Whoopee was good, too.
I don't like that song so much. But that's not the end of that. So, what's going to happen now that Britain has withdrawn from the European Union? Well, the European Union, the remainder of it, led by Germany, is calling for a very swift withdrawal for the Brits for the following reasons. They don't want there to be a positive incentive for other nations to join Britain and to vote to leave the European Union. They want to make this a clean break, and they want to make sure that Britain pays a price for leaving. They don't want them to be able to withdraw from the Union and still enjoy preferential trade agreements and so on and so forth. Basically, they're saying you're either in or you're out, which is a little bit ironic because Britain was never entirely in to begin with. But that's sort of a different story.
Yeah, they
entirely.
Never adopted the euro as their currency.
No, they did not. So what might happen in the not-too-distant future? Well, a couple of years ago, Scotland had a referendum for independence from the United Kingdom, which was narrowly defeated. The Prime Minister of Scotland, I'm not sure if that's the right title, the leader, political leader of Scotland, has already indicated that there will be another referendum on Scottish independence in the not-too-distant future. So we may very well see Scotland vote to leave the United Kingdom and then apply independently for readmission into the European Union.
And Northern Ireland may leave and join Ireland.
That we may see Irish reunification. There are all sorts of things that may happen as a result of Britain electing to leave the European Union. And what's foremost on the minds of Chancellor Angela Merkel in Germany and the rest of the continent are the member nations on the continent itself electing to leave.
Well, it is a very perilous situation. It's also kind of amazing the degree of lying that took place during this campaign to get out of, to force Britain out of the European Union.
A lot of horror stories about brown people, much like we're seeing here in this country.
I think racism was a major force involved. Also a
nationalism.
Sense that Polish workers are bad, you know.
Yep. But not British nationalism. English nationalism. It's important to make that distinction because outside of Britain and Wales, to a lesser extent, the other nations, Northern Ireland and Scotland, they voted to remain with the European Union.
Absolutely. It is also, and so did London, which is the center of economic knowledge in England. I think it's really important, very, very, very important to focus in on the facts of this, including the lies that were told. The British people were told that the huge amounts of money, billions and billions of pounds or dollars, would be saved by this action. In fact, that's totally mythology.
It is mythology. Let's go back to the phones.
Okay.
Anita, good morning.
Good morning. You know, I think, yes, there was quite a bit of that kind of racist mentality, but I would like to add that not just everybody who voted for Brexit was a racist xenophobe. There was quite a bit of vote for Brexit among some in Labour, particularly in northeastern England.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And in Amy Goodman's program, I think Friday, the day after doing postmortems, she interviewed two people from the British left, the Labour Party, one for and one against Brexit. And I'm thinking that perhaps, as the penultimate caller said, there's a real problem with the European Union as it is right now because it's gone so corporate. And, you know, part of the intent is to wipe out the whole social safety net. And I can imagine a scenario that says, hey, we got to get out of this before they pass the TTIP, and maybe we can at least keep Britons, not Britons, considering how Scotland feels about things, keep what's left of our safety net. It's, you know, I think there was a completely different perspective that's getting precious little attention in U.S. press on this, but I completely, utterly, and wholeheartedly concede that not everybody had such lofty motives for voting for Brexit. And I'll take your response off.
No, I think you've made some very good points. I also think that, I mean, the multitude of impulses that are involved in this make a very complex and require a very complex analysis. It's very glib and very easy to say, well, it was this or that. But the fact of the matter is that we are seeing what I call late-stage capitalism all over the capitalist world, and that, in fact, there is an effort throughout Europe to cut back on social democratic reforms, to limit the power of the working people, to create less schooling, in free schooling, to limit the medical care, and all sorts of things like that. And that is a force that feeds into the sense of reaction that led to the Brexit exit. And I think it is important to understand that. The fact of the European Union was not the fact of a good system for everybody. Not at all.
You do realize that the word Brexit is a contraction of Britain and exit.
Yes, so I do.
It's redundant to say Brexit exit.
Okay, right. That's really important, and I'm glad you
it
brought
is.
That up.
Yeah. It is. Let's go back to the phones. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to hear your thoughts on whether poverty and hard times enables racism and xenophobia, and the extent to which that the lower classes or the poor tend to support that sort of demagogy.
Absolutely, economic hard times and poverty exacerbate racism. Absolutely. Look at the history of this country. For decades, poor white folks in this country were encouraged to vote against their own economic self-interest because of racism, because they were told by their economic betters in conservative circles that, hey, you know, times may be tough, but at least you're not black. There is no question that poverty and racism are two sides of a coin. Absolutely.
Should we look at that and reflect on our own politics of the current year?
I think we absolutely should. And if we miss that lesson, that is a huge mistake.
You know, I'm glad you brought this up. There is clearly a set of linked assumptions that are both racist and classist that we see in the reactionary politics that are taking place today throughout the West. And I think it's really, I call this late stage capitalism, but you can give it any number of labels. And I think it's really very scary and very dangerous. And it is important to understand that what is happening in Europe is not just what happened in Great Britain, but what's happening in many, many nations, most notably Greece and Spain right now.
Agreed.
So thank you for the call.
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah. Let's see if we can get one more in. Steve, who do we have next? Jeremy, good morning.
It's not the same.
Hello. Are you there? Doesn't look like Jeremy's
there. Let's go to the next person if we have one. Oh, hey. Okay. Can it be that we're going to have the last word ourselves?
It could be. So sum this up for us, Joe. What's next for the European Union?
I think there's a real and valid fear that the whole enterprise may fall apart. I don't think it's a great likelihood, but it is a possibility. And I think that the meetings with Italy and France and Germany and so on that just took place are showing the awareness of these dangers. The possibility of an irrational, not irrational, but an irrational response throughout Europe is very great. And the fact of the matter is that what was created with the European Union was a papering over of great dilemmas of inequality throughout Europe. For example, when we talk about the anger in Great Britain, there's a great deal of racism, a great deal of dislike of persons of color based on real bizarre prejudices and the sort of prejudices we see in the crazy behavior around football, as a, you know, soccer. Mm-hmm. So we really need to understand that. But beyond that, the fact of the matter is that Polish workers can do much better if they can get a job in Great Britain than they can in Poland.
That's a problem.
Yeah, the distribution of wealth and power in Europe, especially among the Central European, formerly Soviet bloc nations, compared to the Western powers, is enormous and very significant. And the same is true for
Agreed.
The South.
And if we miss the parallels to the United States, we do so at our own peril.
Absolutely. Listen, we'll be back next week, and I have no idea what we're going to talk about.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. Disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival, the hallmark event for the Oregon Food Bank. Once again, with our partners at Oregon Community Media, KBOO will be broadcasting the four-day festival in the Portland metro area, across the state from Astoria to Ashland, and from Andrews to Antelope, and around the world at KBOO.fm. Remember to support your local food bank as you tune in to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, to enjoy the 29th annual Waterfront Blues Festival.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First, Alternative Radio presents the late Howard Zinn speaking on Second Thoughts on the First Amendment. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, reproductive justice advocate Renee Bracey Sherman discusses yesterday's Supreme Court decision striking down Texas anti-abortion laws. Also, investigative reporter Bob Perry examines why the Brits voted to leave the EU. At 11, Stage and Studio presents